Okay, let's look at chapter 5, starting in verse 1. It says, Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of 1,000. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine, and they praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. Stop there. First thing we notice in this chapter is a name change. Okay, we're going from Nebuchadnezzar to Belshazzar. Did you notice that? And so from chapter 4 here to chapter 5 now, decades have passed, actually. Nebuchadnezzar is no longer king of Babylon. History tells us that he reigned for a total of 43 years before dying of supposedly natural causes. He died in his sleep, that's what it said. But he, before he died, had a number of sons and daughters. Well, one of his daughters would marry a man named Nabonidus. That name will come up again. While one of his sons, Amel-Marduk, was the one to succeed Nebuchadnezzar as king. Amel-Marduk was assassinated after only 2 years in office by someone named Nergal-Sar. That man ruled for 4 years himself before dying. I think he was an older gentleman when he got into power, and I think he died on his way returning to Babylon from some conquest or something like that. But that left his child on the throne. No telling how old he was, but he's generally believed to be a bit underage. What that even means, I don't know, but he was a young man, supposedly, and he was beat to death within months. Now, Nabonidus, if you remember that name, this is the one who had married Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. Nabonidus, the son-in-law to the deceased Nebuchadnezzar, took power from there and had a son with Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, and that son was named Belshazzar. That's the king that we read about in chapter 5. So Belshazzar is Nebuchadnezzar's grandson through his mother. So throughout this chapter, you're going to see that Nebuchadnezzar is referred to as Belshazzar's father. It just means ancestor. It wasn't his father. It was, in fact, his grandfather. But the word father, don't let that trip you up when we read it, okay? Now, Nabonidus was really the emperor. He ruled the entire empire from a distant city, Tima or Timan. Is what we're told. Belshazzar ruled Babylon, the capital city. He served as a co-regent or a king in his own right. Belshazzar, he ruled for a total of 17 years, but this chapter only deals with the last day of his life, the fall of the empire. Apart from the prophecies of Daniel, nobody would have seen this coming. Babylon was 60 miles in circumference. It would have taken you 3 long days to walk around the city. It was surrounded by a wall 350 feet high, 40 feet thick. Inside that wall was a moat, okay, of water. Beyond that moat was a whole nother wall. The city was thought to be impregnable, unconquerable. Nobody could ever get in. No invading army was to ever be a concern. On top of the outer walls were towers that rose another 100 feet in the air. And so they had watchmen in those towers. Nothing that happened in the outlying area that they weren't aware of. Anything taking place out there would be reported to the courts within, and they kept track of what was happening in the outer world. The Medo-Persian army, according to Nebuchadnezzar's nightmares and Daniel's interpretations, was the next nation to come into power. Babylon was the head of gold, if you remember the dream. Medo-Persia was the chest and arms of silver. So it's just a matter of time before Babylon is conquered by Medo-Persia. Interestingly, the Medo-Persian army had been encamped outside of the city of Babylon for several months at this point that we read about. And the Babylonians knew it because they could see it plainly from their watchtowers. And history records, I think Josephus writes about it, that the Babylonians laughed about it because they were such a non-threatening group, themselves being inside that walled city. In addition to all this, they had enough grain stored in the city to last 20 years. And so you know how oftentimes armies would lay siege to different cities and starve them out. And so with 20 years' supply of food, they had nothing to worry about. With the Euphrates River running right through the center of the city, which would supply them with all the fresh water that they needed, they felt entirely safe and secure. And that's why we see them in the first four verses of this chapter, even though this is the last day of the Babylonian Empire, why they are acting so flippantly. They're just sitting down to party, drink, have fun, and enjoy themselves. So there's this great big fest happening, a feast of, I don't know, 1,000 lords are there. Every high-profile Babylonian is attending. When it says what it does in the first few verses here, we can understand that this is a big drunken sex party. The concubines have been invited. There are women there. There are drunken men there. We understand what's going on. This is like a frat house with all the sorority girls there as well. Not uncommon for this to be happening among celebrities in a decadent society. This is not a Babylonian thing exclusively. This can happen in American culture too. Sometimes it's the ones that have the most money and popularity and physical appeal that end up having the least amount of integrity and morality and spiritual beauty. That's the case here with this group that we read about in the first four verses. But there's something that's happening here, if we read the details of this section, that leaves us with a sense of disappointment. There are a couple things that have been said that might leave you shaking your head, because we see there's mention made of these beautiful handcrafted golden goblets, these vessels of silver and gold that have been brought out of storage to be filled with wine and treated like red Solo cups at a house party. This is a desecration of what God intended to remain pure and holy. The vessels of the temple in Jerusalem had been taken along with the captives back to Babylon and been utilized in the temple of the demon gods in Babylon for their own purposes. And now these things are being used for their own party. Orgy, if you want to be specific. And you look at this, and even though we're Gentiles, you know, like for the most part, there's no real Jewish connection, but we instinctively know that it isn't right. Okay, that's what they're being used for now was not what they were created for, these golden goblets. Their design was inspired by God. It was meant to be holy. They were meant to be sanctified or set apart for God's explicit use. To try and put this into perspective, think of your toothbrush, okay? Your toothbrush is meant for you exclusively, right? Thank you. And for a very specific purpose. Okay. Yeah. You don't borrow your toothbrush out. That's the one thing I've never heard at church. Hey, can I borrow your toothbrush? You know, and nobody cleans the floor with it. Nobody washes out the sink or dusts the blinds. It's for your exclusive use and always for a very specific purpose. Anyone else using your toothbrush or using your toothbrush for anything else is a repulsive thought to you. And God views us like that. Okay, the very idea of you as a Christian giving yourself over to sin or allowing yourself to be borrowed out to the world to serve the purposes of God's enemies, that's revolting to God. That's why he says, be holy. Be holy. Be pure. What he's saying is, be set apart for my use only. Okay, God doesn't like it at all when we're shared with the world. But these beautiful golden silver vessels, these cups, are now in the hands of careless, godless, reckless pagans. They have become unholy at his very touch. What God considers priceless vessels have become little more than cheap entertainment for those in the world, and this should disturb us. These things, instead of being used to connect people to God and bring them close to him like they were created to do, these vessels are now being used to get people drunk so that those people who are using them get more confused about God and drift even further from him. Gentlemen, if you remember what Alan Redpath wrote in the book that we've been going through in our studies, he says, quote, how often our hearts, with the mark of Christ's ownership upon them, have been filled with the poison of other affections as we have served other gods. He says, we have devoted our surrender and sacrifice to things that are utterly unworthy of those who claim to be children of the King, end quote. And so if you look at these first four verses and go, oh, that's awful, you should. Vessels of God, yes, vessels of God. Are they in the right place? No, they're not. Sometimes location alone, Christian, sometimes location alone determines which God makes the better use of you. You need to be in the right place. Those vessels are not where they were meant to be. And that's not to say that Christians are to live within the walls of the church and never venture out into the world. But the question is, when you're out in the world, what's your purpose? To enjoy it? Are you out in the world to enjoy the world? Ephesians 5:11 says, have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness. Rather, expose them. And I say this because there are many Christians who are really illustrated by these vessels here. There's very little that we shouldn't understand about this. James 1:27 says, keep yourselves from being polluted by the world. Plain and simple. Keep yourselves from being polluted by the world. How do you do that? The only way to keep yourself from being polluted by the world is to consecrate or separate yourself unto or to be sanctified for God's uses only, like a toothbrush. 2 Timothy 2:21 says, if anyone cleanses himself from what is dishonorable, he will be a vessel for honorable use, set apart as holy, useful for the master of the house, ready for every good work. Okay? In verse 5, it says, in the same hour. So there they are having this great sinful celebration with thousands of people in attendance. And right there, in the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. And then the king's countenance changed. That means the expression on his face changed. And his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. He's losing all control of the lower part of his body. I'm not certain about this, but I think I've heard it said that this might even suggest that perhaps he lost control of his bowels. But here it says that his knees knocked together. It's talking about the joints. And so if you've ever been stricken with great fear, you just are overcome with a physical weakness that almost drops you to your knees. And that's at least what's happening with this man. It says, the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. These guys are terribly unreliable. We've learned that much, haven't we? The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple, and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now all the king's wise men came, but they couldn't read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed a second time, I guess, I don't know. And his lords were astonished. The queen, or in this case, the queen mother, this would have been probably not his wife, okay, but rather his mother, an elderly woman who was a little bit more distinguished than to participate in this drunken feast. So she comes from somewhere else. Because of the words of the king and his lords, she then comes to the banquet hall, and the queen spoke, saying, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king," and again, that means grandfather, that's what's being referred to there, "made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers, inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation." So then Daniel was brought in before the king. We'll stop there. If you notice, she is acknowledging the fact that in Daniel is the spirit of the holy God in verse 11. She recognizes this. Others have recognized this, and they will continue to recognize this, even into chapter 6. We saw it in chapter 4. So, like, for decades, he's got a reputation for being a spirit-filled man. And so she remembers him and says, "Listen, there's this man who your grandfather knew. He promoted him. He's full of wisdom and the spirit of the holy God," she says. And so they summoned Daniel, and Daniel's brought in before the king. Now, this is interesting because here you have a spirit-filled man and a wine-filled man standing side by side. One's drunk, okay? Just such a contrast here. Reminds me of Ephesians 5:18, where it says, "Be not drunk with wine, but filled with the Spirit." Don't be like Belshazzar, be like Daniel. That's what Ephesians 5:18 could say. Don't be like Belshazzar, be like Daniel. Okay, "Do not get drunk on wine, which leads to reckless indiscretion." Other translations would say debauchery. Some would say dissipation. Some would say excess. Some would say ruin. "Don't be drunk with wine. Instead, be filled with the Spirit." So here's the difference between these guys. We notice a very sharp contrast. You have over here on the throne a godless man, drunk on wine, drunk on life, drunk on pride. Then you've got Daniel over here, a very wise man, clear thinking, sober minded, and spirit filled. This is just black and white. The only similarity between these two individuals is that they almost have the same name, if I'm reading it correctly. If you remember, Daniel was given the Babylonian name when he first arrived, Belteshazzar, and this guy's name is Belshazzar. And I looked it up, and apparently they mean something very similar. Bel, a demon god, protect the prince. Now, whether that meant anything to Daniel or not, I doubt. But nonetheless, their names are similar, and that's about where the similarities cease. Daniel was one who committed himself to God in his teenage years, if not before. Now he's 82 years old or older. So Daniel has been in Babylon for a long, long time. Belshazzar is quite different. He's lived for pleasure all his life. Never known a day without it. And yet this marks the very end of the road for him. He won't live till tomorrow. History tells us that he was exactly half of Daniel's age. If Daniel was 82, we know from history that Belshazzar was, in fact, 41 when he died. He dramatically shortened his own life because of how he chose to live. Proverbs 20, verse 1 says, "Whoever's led astray by wine is dumb." Verse 13 goes on and says, "Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I've heard of you, that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, they've been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they couldn't give the interpretation of the thing. And I've heard of you, that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Now, isn't it interesting? Belshazzar is talking to Daniel and says, "Are you the one?" In verse 13. In verse 14, he goes, "I've heard of you." In verse 16, again, he says, "I've heard of you." Isn't that crazy? Because I don't know if you realize this, Belshazzar has been king now for 17 years. And Daniel's been floating around the royal court since before Belshazzar was even born. And yet this is the first time they've ever met. That to me is a significant fact. He's heard of Daniel, but he's never taken the time to personally acquaint himself with the prophet. What a shame for him. What a shame that one of the greatest and wisest men of God to ever walk the earth was there the whole time, and Belshazzar never knew about it, never read his prophecies, never learned from his writings, never listened to his insights, never gleaned from his wisdom. A whole book of the Bible has been being written right under Belshazzar's nose, and he doesn't even care. Doesn't care enough to look at it. He had access to the scriptures, but not enough interest to actually read them. Instead, he waits until the very last hour of his life to finally call Daniel in and open himself up to what he has to say. Those who give themselves to wine are dumb. So finally now, he's going to hear this man of God speak some truth to him. He's going to open himself up to what the scriptures might have to say. And unfortunately for him, because he waited so long, the only truth that applies to his situation now is that of judgment. The longer you wait in life, the more that becomes the case. Imagine living like him. Some people in their flesh might go, "Ooh, that sounds nice. Big parties, having fun." I'm not talking about the things that our flesh wants. I'm talking about the things that the Spirit warns of. Imagine living your whole life like he did. Living for pleasure, ignoring the Bible, always finding better things to do than to study God's word, waiting until the very end to try and make sense of your worthless life. It's tragic, but it's also popular. You know that. You just need to look at secular society and see how popular it is. Maybe some of you, it's family, coworkers. We're surrounded by people who are playing that game, living like Belshazzar did. I believe, in fact, that all of us would have gone down that road had we not been rescued by Christ somewhere along the way. Ephesians 2:1-5 says, "As for you, you were dead in your sins, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and of the devil." We all lived like that at one time, gratifying the cravings of our flesh and following its desires and thoughts. Just like the rest, we were by nature deserving of wrath. But that's what makes us different. Same thing with Daniel. What happened with Daniel? Something brought him down a different road. And what was it? Well, it was because of God's great love for us. It says in Ephesians, "Who is rich in mercy, God made us alive with Christ, even when we were dead." We've been saved by grace. That's the only thing that makes us any different from Belshazzar. If it weren't for Jesus Christ, we would be going down the same road and probably already were before we were saved. Daniel chapter 5 is just a picture of what Jesus has saved us all from. A God-mocking life that chases pleasure and ignores warnings and is bound to end prematurely, like Belshazzar's would. If you notice in verse 16, he's saying, listen, if you can tell me the interpretation of this writing on the wall, then I will give you purple clothes, a chain of gold, and I'll make you the third ruler in the kingdom. And Daniel answered and said to the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to somebody else. I'll read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. Daniel is just rejecting it. He's been offered purple clothes and a gold chain. Both of those denote power and authority. Okay, a gold chain like the one that's being described in that verse is one that would be only given by the king to certain select people. And then the purple robe would have been a color of designating authority and power. But then he says also, I'll make you the third ruler in the kingdom. What that means is Nabonidus, you remember, was the emperor. He was the king. Belshazzar was co-regent. So that's the number one and the number two man. And he's going, I'll put you right up here with me and my dad. You can be co-regent just like me. All three of us will rule the kingdom together forever. That's what he's saying. I will put you on par with me. So he's promising Daniel a position of great authority and prestige right alongside him and his father. It's interesting that Daniel refuses this, because if you remember in chapter 2, verse 48, it says that when King Nebuchadnezzar promoted Daniel and gave him, quote, many great gifts, making him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon, Daniel accepted it. When King Nebuchadnezzar promoted Daniel, he accepted it. Belshazzar is wanting to promote Daniel, and he's refusing it. Why? Because in chapter 2, that was decades ago, Babylon still had a future to be promoted into. But now, Babylon has no future. Why would I want to be third in your kingdom when by tomorrow you won't have one? Daniel knows what God has planned, because God has given Daniel the interpretation of the writing on the wall, and Daniel believes God's word, even if Belshazzar doesn't. In verse 18, Daniel speaks to the king and says, O king, the Most High God gave you Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty, glory, and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. You knew all this. And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords and your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you've praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron and wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Daniel speaks with more authority than Belshazzar has ever known, because Daniel speaks on behalf of God. And he says, you saw your grandfather and what happened with him. You knew all of this. He can rightly say that because Belshazzar was 14 years old when Nebuchadnezzar, his grandfather, died. And so he was no doubt associated with the royal court throughout his life. And so he saw firsthand what pride does to a man. He knew that it turned his granddad into an animal for 7 years. And what was that all about anyway? That happening with Nebuchadnezzar. That's kind of a weird thing to do to a guy when he's proud. I'm proud. You're proud. How come we haven't gone crazy like that? Why did God do it to Nebuchadnezzar? He did it to send a message to others. Many people. Belshazzar, his grandson in particular. God intended Nebuchadnezzar's pride and what happened because of it to serve as a warning for Belshazzar. But Belshazzar grew up thinking that that didn't apply to him. I'm telling you that part of the reason God let Nebuchadnezzar go crazy was to show young Belshazzar not to grow up to be like Grandpa. I think that should make us stop and consider what examples God has put before your very eyes throughout your life that were meant to be a warning for you. Your parents' broken marriage? Your alcoholic uncle? Are you going to learn from that, or are you going to make the same mistake? Are you going to consider that to be a warning that God is speaking into your own life to steer you away from making the same error, or are you going to use it as an excuse so that you can? Did you grow up witnessing or experiencing abuse? Did you grow up around crime? Was your household one of continual sin? Because what God means to be a warning for us against committing similar sins, we oftentimes use as excuses to keep committing them. We say, well, that's just how I was raised, or generational curse, if you've heard that one. We sling that out there like it's a Christian thing, and it serves as an excuse for why we still live in sin. Well, it's in my blood, you know? It's in my DNA. We blame it on all kinds of things like that. But that rationale cost Belshazzar his life. He knew better, and Daniel called him on it. You knew all of this. And may we be spared of such tragic thinking as got him killed prematurely. Corrie Ten Boom, if you know who that is, she always said, Jesus died to forgive sins, not excuses. Jesus won't forgive excuses. If you have an excuse for your sin, then you don't need his blood to cover it, do you? You got a fine excuse of your own. And you'll find in the end, all too late, that's not forgiven. Some of us, we make all kinds of excuses and we clamor for reasons to justify ourselves for why we turned out like we did. And I'm sure Belshazzar did the same thing. Well, I had a crazy grandpa, so I'm crazy too. Bring on the booze. In verse 24, Daniel says, then the fingers of the hand were sent from God, and this writing was written. This is the inscription that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, u, farsin. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but it can't be. Many, many, tekel. It took. Mene, mene, tekel, u, farsin. The u, by the way, is in the original language, and. So it's many, many, tekel, and farsin, which is either plural or singular. It will trip you up if you look at when it's repeated. Because in verse 28, it doesn't say you farsin, it says peres. At any rate, Daniel says, this is the interpretation of each word. Mene means God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Simply means numbered. Tekel, Daniel says in verse 27, you have been weighed in the balances and been found wanting. God has evaluated your life and character. You don't measure up. Peres, or farsin, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. It's a very, very simple interpretation. I mean, God couldn't be any more brief and succinct as he was with Belshazzar. Four words. One is repeated. And all it means to us in modern vernacular is, time's up! Time's up! You lose! Here comes the Persians. That's what God is saying to Belshazzar. Time's up. Time is up. You lose. Here comes your enemies. And what's his response to this? Like, this is a pretty blunt message. And this is here's how he responds in verse 29. Then Belshazzar dropped to his knees and pleaded with the Lord for forgiveness. Of course not. It's not what my Bible reads. Belshazzar arose and pleaded with Daniel to pray to his God for forgiveness. Didn't say that either. It says, Belshazzar gave the command and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. What's that all about? This is, I think, an act of total defiance to what was just said to him. Belshazzar makes Daniel the third ruler in the kingdom alongside him and his dad, Nabonidus. Why? Because he still thinks, in spite of what God just told him, that they're going to rule the world together. We have a future. I'll make you third. I don't believe that nonsense you just told me about what God says is going to happen. Persians are at the door. I'm going to promote you. What he doesn't realize is that Persia had already been to Tima and captured Nabonidus, his dad. So there is no other ruler at this point. Belshazzar is all alone. See, he assumes everything is going to be fine, but he's very wrong. God's judgment doesn't concern him a single bit, though it should. That very night, it says in verse 30, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain that night, that very night. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Darius the Mede would have been appointed by Cyrus, the king of Persia, to that position. Darius, in fact, isn't a name, it's a title. And so this is the man that was appointed by Cyrus. So Cyrus is really leading the charge. Darius would have been the one appointed to take over the city. But Belshazzar lived his life by the same old maxim that millions of other people even today are still living by. And you've heard it yourself. It goes, let's eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. This is how many live their life. It's how Belshazzar did. Live for the now. Just indulge. Deny yourself of nothing. Say no to nothing. If sex is what you want, have it. If alcohol is what you want, drink it. If pleasure and entertainment is what you want to live for, then go get it. Chase your dreams. Ignore God. Have fun. Be happy. And don't let anyone try to stop you or tell you no. Eat, drink, and die. That's the world's mantra. And there is no hope for people who insist on living like that. Living like life is just one big endless party meant to be a constant source of pleasure. Those who live that way will find in the end that it always ends in death. That's the wages of sin. Jesus told us so. The writing's on the wall for people like that. Daniel, at 82, somewhere in his early, mid-80s, he doesn't have a whole lot of time left either. He's, you know, time's ticking on him as well. But his life has been no party, we know that. Yet we needn't be worried about him. Daniel's fine. So you got Belshazzar over here, you got Daniel over here, and right in the middle, do you still remember those golden goblets? All those silver and gold vessels that were made for this but being used for that? What about them? They sort of personify those who are created for honor but have become a thing of dishonor. What happens to them now that the party's over? In other words, we get that sinners who deny God and reject Christ to the very end, we know what happens to them. There's no hope. Those who serve God all their lives and are consecrated fully to the cause of Jesus, we know what happens to them. They have a home in heaven. What about everybody in the middle? They were saved somewhere along the way, but then they've turned kind of, and they're living in the world. They're not living like they should. Though they are supposed to be consecrated, though they are supposed to be pure and holy, they're certainly not looking like it, nor are they acting like it. What about all of them? What happens to them now that the party's over? Here's what happens to these in particular. In less than a year's time, Cyrus is going to release the Jews from exile, and he's going to send them back to Jerusalem. Ezra 1:7 says, quote, with the vessels of the house of the Lord that Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and placed in the house of his gods, end quote. So what happens to these vessels? They're going to finally come home to where they belonged in the first place. That's where they will be. Question tonight, where will you be when this party's over? It will end one day. We don't know when, but it will. Luke 21:34 says, and this is a warning to us, if you count yourself as we're somewhere in the middle, we vacillate. Sometimes we live for the world. Sometimes we live for Christ. Jesus says this in Luke 21:34, be careful. Be careful or your hearts will be weighed down with carousing and drunkenness and the cares of this life. Be careful, because that day, whenever it comes, will close on you suddenly like a trap. Nebuchadnezzar didn't realize, I'm sorry, Belshazzar didn't know what was coming and continued to live as if it never would, in spite of the fact that he had been warned time and time again. Daniel knew that it was coming, and he was fully prepared. He got out with his life. He's still alive in chapter 6 under Caesar's under Cyrus's reign. So they didn't kill him. God spared him. You thought that he would have been dead by now, and he's still alive. Belshazzar is gone. The servant of God is still serving his God. But what about us? Where do you sit tonight?